pieces by John Cage, all receiving their BBC Proms premieres pretty much simultaneously. You just heard Partridge Music with Atlas, Eclipticalis and Winter Music. And alongside the members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra were four pianists with powerful connections to the composer: John Tilbury, Frank Denyer, Aki Takahashi and one-time Page pupil Christian Wolff on four instruments in the arena of the Royal Albert Hall. And I didn't mention the two people performing Partridge Music, which started the sequence, people who know it so well, David Behrman and Takahisa Kosugi. And Robert Warby, the people we have performing Cage's music just together in that one sequence is quite astonishing.
It's absolutely amazing. These people knew John, they were friends with him, and they worked with him for years. Christian Wolff met John Cage when Christian was 16.
And just to explain something about Partridge Music, because it, right now it's a piece that effectively has built-in obsolescence, doesn't it? There are problems to solve with any performance today.
Absolutely. I'm just preparing a performance of it in September. It was written for, composed for, record player cartridges, and they're hard to get hold of. And one is supposed to insert into the cartridge objects where the stylus would go, and there are all kinds of problems associated with that.
Well, styluses and cartridges these days are a lot smaller, aren't they? So you have to sort of, well, sleight of hand and alternatives have to be looked for, but the sounds are astonishing. And we're going to be hearing a lot of the same performers again involved in different ways in the second half of this evening's Cage celebration. We'll have Cage's Concerto for Prepared Piano and Chamber Orchestra, where the piano becomes a percussion orchestra all on its own. There's But What About the Noise of Crumpling Paper, for 10 instrumentalists making sounds from only slightly resonant instruments. Then there's what I suppose you could call, in a vaguely Cagean sense, a happening, an improvised quartet, and a piece for amplified plant materials, Branches, which sees the Royal Albert Hall decorated with about 40-plus amplified cacti of different shapes and sizes spread around the stage, the arena, and in a good number of the first and third tier boxes here. It is an extraordinary idea and sound, as you'll be finding out. And during the interval, we can hear Robert Warby at rehearsals finding out how to play a cactus.
I'm in Glasgow because the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, with their conductor Ellen Volkov, are preparing for a performance of music by John Cage. It's a set of works that takes musicians onto another plane. Alongside conventional instruments on stage, I can see jugs of water, cassette players, crumpled paper, ticking clocks, and cactus plants. Cage asks a performer to play a cactus, so we've got to work out now how to play a cactus and also why play a cactus. Musicians are confronted with scores that don't look like music. Cage writes for instruments and he writes for objects, and they're as likely to come from a plumber's merchant as a music shop. I've performed several Cage pieces myself many times, and it always feels like I'm on the edge of a precipice, and I'm always concerned that I may be getting it wrong, that I may be betraying Cage's ideas. Now he's no longer around, we have to work out for ourselves what needs to be done in performance. So as more and more musicians take on the challenge of performing his work, how are they going about it? I'm going to hear from musicians involved in performing Cage's scores. Musicians like John Tilbury, pianist and champion of Cage's music. He's here to play the concerto for prepared piano and orchestra, and his work begins days before the performance, constructing John Cage's most famous instrumental invention, the prepared piano.
These are all bolts of varying sizes and thicknesses. That's not an unprepared sound, the B.
Well, at the moment, I'm just doing what the composer asked me to do in the way of preparing the piano, i.e. inserting bolts, pieces of strips of rubber, wood, plastic, which, of course, totally transform the sound of the piano. These objects are actually, in the main, inserted between the strings of the notes, thereby transforming the sound totally. And he actually stipulates large bolts, long bolts, small bolts, headless bolts, stove bolts, furniture bolts. That's a rather large bolt in there. In fact, I think it's more than one, it's two bolts. One can't be too literal about these scenes. I mean, what is a headless bolt? What is a rubber bolt? Apparently rubber bolts are used by plumbers, but I couldn't find a plumber who had one, so I had to encase a metal bolt in a rubber stripping. Those kinds of compromises had to be made, which I think is totally acceptable, and Cage would have gone along with that. It shouldn't be too much of a beautiful music kind of piece. It's got a, you've got to have these maverick sounds, which if I can find one, that one you see, that there you can, there's wood. The bolt is pushed right down hard against some wood, which is in a way protecting the soundboard. When you hear that kind of click, that's quite a brutal sound, especially in the contra. Those sounds. That's all part of it, though. I think those sounds which seem to be out of place or somehow, well, they're ugly sounds, annoying sounds of a listener, perhaps, but that's all part of it, part of the piece. That is an interesting sound because it has rubber attached to it. You can almost hear that rubbery sound, as opposed to that, which is pure metal. That is metal and rubber. The what Cage gave us is the idea, the permission to make the music that we really wanted to make. He is a kind of liberating effect that we need not be constrained by Western musical traditions. You could say that playing Cage is a kind of study, if you like, for improvising because of the freedom it enables you. And which is ironic in a way, because Cage was very much against improvisation. He was, Cage taught about freedom and offered it in a way in his musical practice, but I think was a conditional freedom. In other words, you know, if you want to be free, do this. It's a bit like politicians and economists, even dictators. So I think there was a flaw in that aesthetic, but that's another story.
Pianist John Tilbury. Right from the beginning of Cage's career, Schoenberg famously described him as an inventor of genius. This wasn't meant to be a compliment at the time, but now it seems like a great way to look at Cage, who throughout his working life took music and pushed it as far as it would go. This concert with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra is a good example of some of the quite extraordinary demands that are made on the performers, even beyond the meticulous preparations of the piano. Ilan Volkov is a conductor and performer and another champion of John Cage's music, and in many ways the brains behind this performance with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra.
Hi everyone. This piece does not require the usual practicing of scales and intonation, but it needs to kind of, you have to have kind of an attitude that's specific for this music and also to understand the notation. Now let's just read it and we can understand. Events are single tones or aggregates in times. So what he means here, aggregates in times, constellation. The way the notation was done, they superimposed the pieces of paper on top of star maps. So that's Atlas Eclipticalis, it's the name of the, it's like the book of the stars. So you have to try to follow that notation. That notation, if you don't, then it's just, it's not really what he's trying to do. Here we go.
Ellen, let's start with Atlas Eclipticalis. Can you describe what's printed on the score in front of you, and how do you interpret that? How do you know what to do?
Well, it's interesting because the conductor part is very different from the player's part. So, first of all, there is no score. The interesting thing in this piece is that every person really controls his own destiny, in a sort of, if one puts it that way. So each person decides for himself the speed and which notes he will choose. And that's why, I mean, it's such an amazingly complex piece which allows for so many things to happen. It takes quite a while to first understand the text. The actual, not the notation, but the description of the notation.
The explanation. The instructions,
exactly,
what to do.
Exactly. And that takes a bit of time to figure out. And when you do figure out, everybody needs to find their way into it because they're kind of playing from a notation that they don't know. If they play any other kind of normal new music, they're using the standard notation that Beethoven and Mozart use. But here we're talking about a completely different way of approaching it. And it always takes quite a while for everybody to feel comfortable. And maybe they shouldn't feel too comfortable as well. And there is sort of an energy that just arises from this fact that everybody's in a new position. It's such a utopian idea to write a piece for so many instruments, writing so many notes there and so many descriptions, and then telling them you could choose to play almost zero out of what's written or all of it, and in between. It's an amazing gift that he gives because he takes away so much of the control he has. Of course, he still has quite a lot of control, a lot of control. And it's not in improvisation in any way. So there's a big, big distinction there. It's not play what you want. And if the orchestra would do a piece that play what you want, it wouldn't sound like that, not even similar. So, I mean, that's the interesting, it's kind of in between the worlds of composition and total free improvisation. But, I mean, I think the fascinating thing is how he gives away his power, which really makes the performer and the listener, I think, a much more active participant.
How do you know that what you're doing as a performer is correct? Is there a right and wrong way of performing Cage's work?
Well, I think it starts with taking it very seriously. I mean, not in a pompous, ponderous way, but really take the text that's there and especially the instructions seriously and try to understand why he wrote each sentence. You know, Cage was, you know, not so helpful about it. That's why it's much easier to do that stuff now after he's dead. Because, you know, like any composer after they die, there is a sort of space that kind of suddenly around the pieces, there is much more space to do things. Still to follow the ideas of the composer, but to have more real interest in the work and not kind of this idea of authentic nature or you're trying to do it exactly the way he would have wanted. Because always the instructions are always a little bit unclear. So they always leave a little bit of flexibility. And you have to leave that flexibility there. You cannot try to close the door.
So we've got plant pots and lampshades and toys, xylophones and pillows and cooking implements and keys and wood blocks and paper and water vessels and lots of other things probably. I'm Nick Fells. I'm working with this group of people that have come together to do some non-orchestral Cage pieces. We're doing a piece called What About the Noise for a number of percussionists. So we need at least two sounds, preferably more. And then there's a score which is kind of like a series of full stops, dots, which signify rests, basically silences. And then plus signs, which signify sounds. And then a series of circles, which are water sounds or nature sounds or paper sounds. Given 10 minutes of reading and thinking, it's okay. It's actually quite straightforward to play. It's mainly thinking about it, really. Just making sure that you understand Cage's instructions properly. And then a case of honing the sound quality of the on the instruments you're playing. Yeah, that's about it, really. I think sometimes the pieces are deceptively simple, and the scores and the instructions seem simple when you kind of figure out how to do the piece, but then when you come to do a performance or you're in a real kind of performance space, as we are tonight, and it's then you realise the listening aspect becomes very, very important. And sometimes the instructions are obscure or ambiguous, and you have to just decide sometimes what to do about something. So he can be quite, what's the word, contradictory sometimes. And I think that's deliberate, and it's part of the, you know, leaving a lot of responsibility in the hands of the performers to make decisions. You know, you just have to make a creative decision about it.
Child of Tree is a piece that's generated a lot of attention in this concert because the performance involves amplified cactus plants. Like a lot of John Cage's music, it makes us look beyond musical traditions and outside the concert hall. It's actually a rare opportunity for the orchestral management to consult a gardening expert.
My name's Hamish McKelvey. I'm a member of the Glasgow branch of the British Cactus and Succulent Society. And these plants, I just grow them because I like them. I've always liked them. I've been asked, could I supply some cactus for some individual? Now, I don't know who he is or anything that's going to do it. He probably knows more than I do about cactus, whether there's music therein or not. I've tried them and I'm afraid I don't see much music in them. I must admit, I had a good laugh about it. Who on earth wants to play music on a cactus? But I'm really looking forward to hearing the sounds from these plants, because they've been sitting here dumb for many, many years, so now some of them are going to speak back. Labivias, we have Echinocerus, which grow in Arizona. Lophophorus, this is the peyote cactus. Trichocerus, this furry thing here, it doesn't look like it, but this is an Opuntia. This is Copiapoa scopolina. These are all gymnocolysiums. And
one has a
patch,
it's just like arpeggios, you know. But it's very much depending on the material. Sounds quite different. Right, we're trying to rehearse Child of Tree by John Cage, and we have a few cacti here, some very beautiful ones, and we have dear Graham trying to find a way to amplify them, basically.
Make it a bit less.
I think it's better if the actual contact mic is inside there as well somehow. It's quite cool, this one, I think. Let's try the same microphone on this. Can we? Each one of those really have a different color, a different sound. Because of the spikes, they're very different, and the material of the spikes is different from each one. I mean, they sound completely different. So when you amplify them, especially, the sound is very different. This sounds very different from this one. I mean, you'll hear it when. It says 8 minutes piece, so, and then it says it has four parts, and then it tells you how to decide how long each part is by chance-operated method. But then it doesn't tell you what to play or how to play. So it even says there it's in improvisation. So only the kind of rules are. Okay, let's try this. This is going to work. Because it picks up the high ones.
Yes.
So I'm just like using a opener for a hotel key, going up and down a quite big cacti plant called Tina, apparently. Yeah, that's fine. So I think let's just go with this. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Ellen, Child of Tree is perhaps inevitably the piece which has attracted the most attention in this concert in Glasgow, mainly because of the unusual instrumentation. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece, Child of Tree?
I think the title tells quite a lot, but I think there's a kind of interest in Cage's work with ecological themes and nature. I think this piece is a kind of, he kind of sort of found out that, you know, if you put a microphone inside the cacti, the cacti becomes a kind of amplified instrument, and every spike you play has a different pitch and a different color. And so you almost can make scales and melodies with it. And then he found out that every cacti, every plant has a completely different sound, even though they look similar. So that's what he's kind of playing with here, and also kind of giving the performer a lot of freedom with choice of the instruments, you know, the plants, and the choice of how, what to play and how to play them.
So for you, as a performer, what does Cage let you do that no other composer does?
For me, I am a classical performer, but I'm also interested in other forms of new music, and I'm also improviser, and I find that Cage kind of touches on both in some way, but he has his own language, and you still have to really understand his world like you do, like you have to understand Schubert or Beethoven in a similar way, but because he dealt with so many concepts and ideas, it's almost like you really, it's a really philosophical act to play his music. It's not only about, oh, this sounds beautiful. There's much more there, and there's ideas that you talk about. And when you start to understand it as a performer, you suddenly, a whole new world opens up.
The sound of an amplified cactus is bizarre. Those little tiny sounds that come from the prickles, that come from the spines, that come from these weird leaves of the plant, amplified, sound like nothing else on earth. In his life, John Cage was an inventor, as mischievous as he was profound, and his joyous personality infects the music making happening here in Glasgow, at the Proms, and all over the world. He asked performers to be rigorous and yet free, to keep up with him, and to be as brave as he was. And the performer's inspiration is shared by the audience. Cage's work gives rise to more questions than answers. And now that he's not around to help us, we have to work it out for ourselves, exactly as the performers are doing here. It will continue to astonish us as much as it mystifies and exhilarates us. And as John himself would have said, isn't that marvellous?
Sounds of amplified cactus plants as performed by Ilan Volkov. How to Play a Cactus was presented by Robert Warby and produced in Glasgow by Douglas Templeton. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, and this is our combined celebration of John Cage's centenary and commemoration of his death 20 years ago this week. Throughout the prom season, it's hard not to call every other concert extraordinary for one reason or another, but this one really is. The sounds, the complexity of making it all work at all, the sheer numbers of people involved, the electronics, those plants, and the most awe-inspiring assembly of Cage practitioners and associates, the generation that knew him in person, and a new generation of artists and musicians drawn to Cage's ideas and to music. Well, Robert Warby's with me here in the hall now, and to start the second half, we're going to hear a performance of Cage's Concerto for Prepared Piano and Orchestra from John Tilbury with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Ilan Volkov. And if, by the way, you'd like to see the names of the performers, the pieces, or listen, then go to the Prom's homepage where you'll also find the Prom in HD sound online. Now, Robert, this is the first work, the concerto, where Cage actually used the Chinese Book of Changes, the I Ching, to help determine outcomes, isn't it? At least in the last movement.
Yes, in the last movement, absolutely right, Andrew. At the first two movements, he used what he called a chart technique, which had a kind of grid that had different kinds of sounds in the grid. And as he went along, he could just read you know, for example, number four across, number six down gives you that sound. And as he was writing this piece, Christian Wolff, who's here tonight, gave John Cage a copy of the I Ching, which his parents published. His parents were classic scholars, and he's a classic scholar, and they ran a publishing house. And John was drawn to the look of the hexagrams, because they looked like the charts that he was working with when he was composing the Concerto for Prepared Piano and Orchestra. And in the third movement, he used the I Ching for the first time.
And this prepared piano, pretty much Cage's own invention. It's a percussion orchestra in its own right, isn't it? It just replaces the kinds of things he was used
Absolutely.
To working with.
Absolutely. He invented it out of necessity in 1940. He was writing a piece for a dancer, Sylvia Fort, who wanted the music to sound African, and she commissioned Cage to do this because he ran a percussion ensemble. But in the theatre where the dance performance was taking place, there was no room for the instruments, so he had to use a piano. And he realised that this didn't sound African. There was something wrong with the piano. He needed to modify the sound of the piano, and he did it with nuts and bolts and weather stripping and pencil erasers.
And it does make an extraordinary set of sounds. Well, by adopting these chance procedures, was Cage effectively abandoning his role as the composer to decide outcomes in his music? Well, here's his reply.
Not abandoning it, simply changing it from the responsibility of making choices to the responsibility of asking questions. And I do ask the questions, and I try to ask radical questions. I mean to say questions that get at the roots of things. If I succeed in asking radical questions, then the answers, even though they come through chance operations, will be, I believe, revelatory in the sense of revealing to me more of creation than staying with my mind the way it was would have revealed. Who was it said that, it was Eric Satie, said that experience is a form of paralysis, because we get absolutely stuck with our ideas. Through chance operations and faithfulness to them, we can get free of that paralysis.
John Cage. And Robert Warby, the idea of removing one's own intention from the process, this disciplined use of chance, it is very different from improvisation and the idea of personal preference and memory.
Absolutely, absolutely. Improvisation is generally about the player. When you think of jazz, we know of all the great players, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, all those people, and it's about them. And Cage wasn't really interested in that. He was interested in sound and liberating sounds from the performers, from his own likes and dislikes, from his ego, from his experience.
And we haven't really talked about John Tilbury, the soloist, tonight, because it's him that does the piano preparation. It takes some time, doesn't it?
It does. It takes a long time. Cage gives very precise measurements for where these objects placed in the strings should go. But John has been playing this music for a long time, and he knows by ear exactly where to put the objects to give that absolutely unique, astonishing sound of the prepared piano.
Well, I think everything is ready on stage now. The piano has certainly been prepared for the whole of today. It glitters beautifully when they lift the lid, and you can just see all of the workings, all of the nuts and bolts and strips. And in fact, I think there's a sort of plastic bridge installed as well, isn't there, which gives microtones in.
That's right, yeah, absolutely correct. So that can be moved around to actually give those microtonal, that strange timbre, that bell-like inharmonic spectrum.
And something else we haven't talked about is, okay, we've got that percussion instrument, which is just this prepared piano, but we also have a pretty magnificent percussion section at the back of the chamber orchestra.
We do indeed, and don't forget we also have a piano that's not prepared,
yeah,
and a celeste. So it's quite an interesting ensemble, but a small ensemble. And I think we noticed in the first movement, for example, that the piano and the orchestra never actually play together like one would expect in a concerto. The piano plays separately, the orchestra plays separately. And he composed the two parts independently of each other and then sort of put them together.
And in terms of the percussion instruments on stage, it almost dwarfs the rest of the orchestra. We've got several players at the back, a huge array of conventional tuned and untuned percussion, but some pretty special Cajun sounds as well, as you'll be hearing. I think I should rather hold my fire on telling you what they actually are and just let you experience them for yourselves. Well, I think everybody is on stage ready to go now. Everything's plugged in, everything's ready to go, and we're just waiting for John Tilbury and Ilan Volkov. Here they come. John Tilbury, the soloist for the Concerto for Prepared Piano and Chamber Orchestra by John Cage. And Ilan Volkov to conduct the members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you.
John Cage's Concerto for Prepared Piano and Chamber Orchestra from 1951, performed by pianist John Tilbury with members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the man behind this John Cage centenary celebration at the BBC Proms, Ilan Volkov. And yes, in that percussion section you heard the sound of, well, a generator, a buzzer, there was a transistor radio as well. That wasn't the noise of a local pirate radio station breaking in. Car brake drums, all sorts of other things as well. And John Tilbury's place as a Cajun of the First Order hardly needs emphasising by me. He actually made a gorgeous recording of Cage's sonatas and interludes for prepared piano back in the, I think it was the 1970s, for the Decca Headline label, which I've still got at home somewhere on LP. And Ilan Volkov and John Tilbury showing their appreciation to the massed ranks of the percussion section at the back of the stage. Shaking hands and bowing to the promenaders in the arena. Still with quite a lot of equipment distributed amongst them as well, I have to say. And we look forward to hearing some of that in a moment. Well, we're going to hear a former bandmate of John Tilbury's, guitarist Keith Rowe, in an improvised quartet before the last piece, Branches, where Cage explores the musical potential of the close-miked cactus, as we heard in the interval. But first, there's another nature piece, if I can call it that, exploring the micro-resonant properties of mainly natural materials. It's called But What About the Noise of Crumpling Paper? Actually, that's only part of the title, and Robert Warby wants me to give you the whole thing. It's about Strasbourg-born artist and sculptor Jean Arp, and here is the full title. But what about the noise of crumpling paper, which he used to do in order to paint the series Papier Froissé, or tearing up paper to make papier déchiré? Arp was stimulated by water, sea, lake, and flowing waters like rivers, forests. Well, that is the whole title. Cage wrote this for Les Percussions de Strasbourg and asked each of the players to use two or more only slightly resonant instruments made of different materials, their choice, but preferably including wood, metal, and glass, and involving the pouring and bubbling of water and the tearing, crumpling, or vibrating of paper. Well, we have on the tables of our instrumentalists in the arena a wide range of materials. An antler, dry grass, leaves, wooden blocks, Hungarian dried peppers from one of the players' kitchens, an ice bucket, plastic tube, all kinds of things. The lights are going down. Stand by. Well, you can tell by the audience's reaction what a magical sound that piece made all around us here in the Royal Albert Hall. But what about the noise of crumpling paper? John Cage's centenary tribute to Jean Arp, written in 1985, performed at Cage's own centenary celebration at the Proms this evening by 10 instrumentalists, composers, artists and improvisers. That new generation of Cage enthusiasts to sit alongside the four seasoned performers we're about to hear playing together, improvising a quartet. By the way, this concert's getting a bit of a following on Twitter. We had a tweet from Richard Whitelaw: the seeds of all the current experimental music I love are heard in tonight's prom. If you'd like to contribute, hashtag BBC Proms. I think Rich is actually in the audience here tonight, so that's a tweet from the coalface, if that's not a slightly unfortunate canary in a mineshaft kind of metaphor. Well, let's introduce our quartet of improvisers. From left to right on stage, they're going to be guitarist Keith Rowe, playing a small tabletop guitar. Takehisa Kosugi, who used to tour with John Cage and David Tudor, he's got a pair of analog oscillators, guitar effects pedals, a tiny mixer and equalizer. David Berman is next along, composer and multimedia artist, playing a guitar through a laptop and an effects processor. And next to him at the piano is Cage disciple Christian Wolf. That piano's just being moved and they're checking the plugging of all the various instruments and things. And Robert Warby, performers of real stature in something like this. They know each other really well, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. Keith Rowe played in AMM along with Cornelius Cardew, who was, of course, a Cage disciple as well. I think it was Cardew who introduced Don Tilbury to Cage's music. Kosugi and David Berman toured with Cage endlessly, toured with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. In fact, they were telling me in rehearsal that they heard John Cage and David Tudor playing cartridge music in 1960, the year that they wrote that he wrote that piece. So they go back a long time indeed.
And it's a fascinating range of equipment. Some of it really simple, like those analog oscillators that just generate tones as they're lifted and lowered and put through the effects. Actually, I was asking David Berman earlier to tell me what the parameters are for the performance. He says there's no starting point, no plan, just a duration. And he said, well, four different personalities, four ways of making sound, four musicians that know each other's style so well as improvisers that they can accommodate each other's ideas and reactions without obscuring one another. So I think it's fair to say that we and they genuinely have no idea how this quartet is going to sound. Have you had any inkling at all?
No, not at all. I think this is an interesting kind of contrast to the other music that we've got in the concert. This is improvisation. And although Cage wrote about three or four pieces called Improvisation 1, Improvisation 2, Improvisation 3, as we were discussing before, he wasn't that keen on improvisation. So this is like the other side of Cage in a way, in that these performers knew him and his music really well. So obviously their relationship with Cage is going to influence their aesthetic, their approach. I'm fascinated to think about what we're about to hear. I've absolutely no idea.
Well, I think we are just about to find out. Let's see if our improvising quartet are appearing on stage. Here they come, out of the tunnel. Keith Rowe, Takehisa Kosugi, David Berman, and Christian Wolf.
Thank you. Thank you. Catherine plays it.
Quartet improvised live on the Royal Albert Hall stage by David Berman, Takahisa Kosugi, Keith Rowe and Christian Wolfe. Which, as Robert Warby was saying, might not be the most Cajun thing we've heard all evening, but the last thing we're going to hear tonight most certainly is the sound of amplified cacti, John Cage's piece Branches, which if you heard Robert Warby at rehearsals in the interval, you'll already know quite a lot about. Now, Robin Shulkowski is the performer who begins the piece from her table on the main stage of the Royal Albert Hall, and that's with the rest of the hall in darkness. And after her solo, Child of Tree, each of the other 19 players is illuminated in pools of light as they pluck the needles of their cacti, all of them amplified and mixed from the centre of the arena. We have cactus pluckers at the back of the stage, four spread around the arena amongst the promers, and the rest distributed in first and third tier boxes all over the hall. And here comes Robin Shulkowski to begin the performance of Branches with her solo, Child of Tree. Branches by John Cage. The sound of amplified cacti and Mexican scene pods and bamboo scrapers and all kinds of other plant material from every corner of the Royal Albert Hall in a performance led by percussionist Robin Shulkowski, with sound design in the hall by Phil Wright and Robert Warby. What an intriguing, absorbing, a beautiful sound that is.
Utterly fascinating, absolutely amazing. Towards the end of his life, Cage became very interested in natural materials, and this is a manifestation of that interest, isn't it? That he's playing entirely with materials that can be found in nature. Utterly fantastic. The sound world was gripping for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It was like sitting in multiple rainforests.
It is several rainforests
all superimposed one on top of another.
Well, now we've got all the performers back on stage joining Robin Shulkowski for the applause. And she was telling me earlier why the cactus is such a good choice for the piece, not just because of the highly pluckable spikes, obviously, but because it's a succulent with a high water content, and the sound vibrations travel well through the water, even inside a plant. And I've just been joined by the curator of tonight's John Cage Centenary Prom, Ilan Volkov, and everybody else is coming back onto the stage as well. Now, Robert, you met and worked with John Cage not that long before his death, I think at the end of the 80s, didn't you? Now, did he give you any advice about performing his music? Everybody seems to get something when they meet him.
They do, that's true. I worked with him at the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival in 1989, and at the end of the festival I realised he was just exactly twice as old as me, and I asked him, what advice have you got for a younger composer? And he said, Robert, get out of whatever cage you happen to be in. He was advising me to get on with my own work. Pay no attention to me, is what he said.
Beautiful. Well, what a centenary celebration this has been. A real tribute to Ilan Volkov, also the members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And don't forget, you'll find a full list of the works, the performers, on the BBC Proms website, which is where to head if you want to hear any of these sounds again. And I'm sure many of us will. Well, Robert Warby, thanks so much for your company and insights. As Christian Markley promised us before his new piece this evening, and he's back on stage as well, I think we'll all be listening to sounds differently on the way home, and maybe looking at our houseplants in a new light. I don't think we have a single cactus in our Radio 3 studio in Broadcasting House, so instead, here's the succulent Jonathan Swain.
Andrew, thank you. Andrew McGregor in the rainforests of the Royal Albert Hall. Well, two proms tomorrow. The first is in the afternoon. Nicholas Collen conducting the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group and the London Sinfonietta Voices, in music by Alexander Gurr and the Ophelia pieces by Oliver Nussen, who's 60 this year. There's also a colourful new piece by Simon Bainbridge, The Garden of Earthly Delights. That's live from the Cadogan Hall in London here on Radio 3, starting at 3 o'clock. Then in the evening, we're back in the Royal Albert Hall, the London Philharmonic, under their principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky, and Mahler's Songs of a Wayfarer with soprano Alice Coote and Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony. It should be good, that. Remember their all-Hungarian prom last year, breathtaking Kodály Dances of Galanta and Bartók's First Piano Concerto with Jean-Yves Bavouzet. The LPO Yurovsky prom is at 7:30 tomorrow night. Well, back to tonight, and in just under 10 minutes, World Roots, Lopakatari tonight, with a mix of sounds from across the globe, including a session by the Brazilian-American outfit Nation Beat, who combined traditional Brazilian maracatu drumming with funk, country and blues. World Roots is at 11:30. Until then, well, I suppose there are more unexpected things in music than Bruckner for a male singer, a horn quartet, three yodelers and a humming chorus. Also, it's a Bruckner piece lasting a mere 7 minutes, which isn't that surprising, of course, if you know his wonderful motets. As for the yodelers, angelic ones, perhaps. This is Bruckner's Abend Zauber, Evening Magic, the piece written in 1878. And the scene painted here is one of forests surrounding a lake lit by a silvery moon, and the air filled with the song of a nightingale, all of which prompts thoughts of being carried aloft to heaven.
Sie träumt sie Sonne leuchtet.
Abend Zauber, literally evening magic, by Bruckner, an evening somewhere in the Austrian uplands, prompting thoughts of being borne aloft to heaven. The solo baritone there, Markus Krause, with the South German Vocal Ensemble and the Marie-Louise Neunecker Horn Ensemble, conducted by Rolf Beck.
The Pride of London. In this Olympic and Paralympic year, the BBC Proms is celebrating music written for, in and about London. And on Sunday night, you can hear Gilbert and Sullivan's take on the city. The Yeoman of the Guard is the grandest, most emotionally engaging of all of the G&S Savoy operas, set in one of the most important parts of Tudor London, the Tower. Jane Glover conducts the cast with the BBC Singers and the BBC Concert Orchestra. Sunday night at the BBC Proms at 7:30 on Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90-93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 11:30 and now World on 3 with Lopa Qatari.
A bit of Ethiopian soul from Boston-based Debo Band to start tonight's World on Three. Surprising though it may seem, Boston is not such an odd place to find the influence of Ethio-Jazz, since its pioneer, Mulatu Astatke, studied at the city's premier music school, Berklee College of Music, back in the 60s. Debo Band is an 11-piece group headed up by Ethiopian-American saxophonist Danny Mekonnen. The band got together in 2006 and they've just brought out their eponymous debut album on Sub Pop Records. And it's pretty good. The music is largely original, but it also has some reworkings of traditional Ethiopian standards and folk tunes. And it was produced by Google Bordello's Ethiopian bass player Tommy T. Well worth a listen. You're listening to me, Lopa Kotari. The band in session on tonight's programme is from New York. They're called Nation Beat. And theirs, as you will hear, is a marriage of New Orleans and the street music of the northeast of Brazil. So, given that it's a shorter programme than usual tonight, let's get on with the music. I have for you a trio of tunes from Italy, stuff that's both out there musically and geographically. First up, multi-instrumentalist Enzo Avitabile, who likes to mix jazz with Bortari, the traditional southern Italian rhythms made by banging wine barrels and wooden drums. In his latest album, Black Tarantella, he continues to experiment, collaborating with Bob Geldof and Giovanni Diabate, amongst others. This track is Let's Raise a Hand, featuring fellow Italian singer Raiz.
Voce nom, voce amico, voce popolo, voce di, voce nom, voce amico, voce popolo, voce di, voce Боже нам, Боже мій, Боже Бог, Боже ти.
Thank you. Muero remolo, no anda quieto. Muero revolcón, no papadea. No pestañea, no duerme. Cuando habla de ella.
Cinghiale Matto, Crazy Boar, from a group that has undoubtedly been influenced by Italy's foremost music freethinkers, Paolo Conti and Vinicio Capossela. Gatto Molesta is an urban punk folk group from Forlì in the city of Romagna in the northeast of Italy. The album, Vecchio Mondo, Old World, is a bit too pop in places, but that track is where, for me, it all comes together in one enjoyable mouthful. And in the middle of that trio was a slow-paced, almost dirge-like piece from Banda Ionica called Espinita. Italy has a long tradition of big orchestras, and it's going strong with at least 5,000 of these sorts of groups still around.